I missed a couple of slides. I don't know how many of you, what you know, but as you're thinking about the Bible, you've got three main guys, right? Abraham, who's his son? Isaac. This stuff you want to know if you didn't, you know, get it in your lifetime. And we saw the scene with the sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. And then Isaac has a son, and what's his name? No. Good. Isaac's son. Close. That's his grandson. What? Jacob is the son of Jacob and Esau are sons of Isaac. Right? So they're sort of third generation. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Can be confusing, that's why I'm pausing over this, right? There's a lot of names there. But this is the foundation text in Western civilization, so we might know it a little bit. It also happens to be a foundation text for Islam, so it'll help you there, right? Then we looked a bit at the story of Jacob and Esau, and we saw how Jacob twice tricked Esau. And you ask the question, why is the Bible telling us this story about a tricky person? I thought this was the word of God, you know, with all our rules. And the guy with a big beard. And all I can say is, I didn't write it. This is the way it comes to us. And the way it comes to us, and if you're a believer, you believe Moses wrote this, and if you're not, you think a bunch of scholars put it together. The way it comes to us is a story about a guy who tricks his older brother and wins, right? And what that has to do with God is not real clear, but that's what we have. One suggestion is it shows the sort of triumph of the clever and the powerless, the younger son. So the Bible is intrinsically about the oppressed and not the powerful. Some people think of that as the ultimate Christian message, and it may be. But you can also argue that it's also right there in the Hebrew Bible, also known as the Old Testament. Right? There's another concept I wanted to bring out because when I was in college, if you were an English major, you had to take an exam on the Bible in your junior year, and I was pre-med and. I showed up at that baby without knowing anything and flunked it. But I remember the question I flunked was this one that said, discuss the theme of covenants in the Old Testament. All right, and of course nobody had ever told me what that was, but it was clearly important to the people who were giving me the exam, so I thought I'd just mention it here. The Old Testament is a series of covenants or promises, contracts between God and the world. And I've given a few, and you might keep your eyes open for others. And if you go back and read the complete thing, which I highly suggest, because it's a little different experience reading the complete thing from the abstract, you'll notice that there are a number of these covenants. The first one is this deal between, after God destroys man because he figures they're so evil, he promises Noah not to do it again. This is a promise for the world. Then there's this covenant with Abraham, and then there's this other covenant later that you don't have, but I just picked it out of the Bible. There's this sort of digging the well scene, and Abraham the point seems to be this is where he's originally promised the land that becomes this promised land, right, of the Hebrew race, which is so powerful today and still a political influence. So there are other covenants, but this isn't a theology class, but I thought I'd just mention them. The theme of intermarriage and incest, again, if you go back and read the Bible, what you notice is that it's a pretty wild world there among these people. And I like to notice that, just because it's interesting, there are plenty of Jews marrying non-Jewish women in the Bible, right? This culminates with Solomon, who is like scandalously involved with pagan women, but it runs through the whole thing. So there's a diversity element working in the Bible right away, and people ignore it, but they're ignoring what's there. right? Which is that there is no pure race in this thing. And that ideology is something that comes, that people impose on this, but you'd be hard-pressed to argue it's found in the text. For example, Isaac married, who's the number two guy, remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Isaac marries Rebekah, but she's the daughter of a Syrian. But then again, they also have a secondary genealogy. Somebody probably stuck it in. Well, I think she should be sort of Jewish, even though they're not really Jewish at this stage. And they make her Abraham's, a descendant of Abraham's brother. Right? Jacob, whose story we're in with the Joseph story, has 12 children. They do not all come from one woman. Right? They come from a variety of wives. And he's got two wives in particular that later commentators used to remark on. This is not particularly in the Bible, but all Christian theologians like to think in terms of a very simplified view of the world. You can be in the contemplative life or the active life. And some of us are scholars, and some of us run for president, right? Right. Some of us watch the football games, and some of us sit home and read a book. Right? And this this dichotomy was often symbolized by Leah, the wife represented the contemplative life, whereas Rachel represents the active life. Right? She's the mother of Benjamin and Joseph, who are the younger ones. Well, there's plenty of unseemly going on in the Bible. This is what used to keep people interested in it, partly, including what we've seen. Joseph, Potiphar's wife, goes after Joseph and accuses him of rape, and that's how he gets into prison. He himself marries an Egyptian. Okay, so his children are half Egyptian. Okay, and there's nothing wrong with him, right? It's perfectly normal. So there it is. And the later generations, they ignore this and everything, but there's the evidence. King David, who is really the subject of most of the Bible, and you don't get any of it in the excerpt, he's got a wildest home life you ever want to run into, right? I mean, half wives and half daughters, and the kids are like, you know, tiptoeing down the hall after each other all the time. I mean, it's a wild scenario in David's house, right? And David himself famously seduces Bathsheba. Okay, and to get at her, sends her husband off to fight in a war and puts him in the front lines, so he'll get killed. Right? This is a bad boy. But he's got something God liked, so don't ask me why. This is the mystery. But this is part of the story. Right? That somehow there's an inherent whatever. Okay. So here we are getting up to the Joseph story. Jacob, in a part that's left out, but seems to me just worth mentioning, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, I had to do this quickly, but if I made any mistakes, Jacob at some point wrestles with an angel. And during that, according to some commentators, his name is changed to Israel. So he's got two names. It gets confusing. Now, your footnotes derived, I think, the name Israel from something else. So clearly we have competing commentators. And I'm just stressing, the big thing we're stressing in here is these things are, there are competing commentaries. But it's really a crucial scene, I think, because it's the reality of the spiritual struggle that everybody goes through. Whether you believe in God or not, or whatever you believe, it doesn't matter. It's pretty hard to avoid the fact that that we don't have the answer to life or the world, right? And that's probably enough, right? It may be Jacob's feeling guilty about defrauding his brother Esau, but that's a sort of more literal explanation. But somehow he wrestles with the angel. And it's one of the more powerful scenes because it just represents you can be wrestling with an angel in your disbelief or your belief or whatever. Right? So that's... Now, we talked about the Joseph's dreams last time, and here I just do a slide to review them. So you mark them down, and we got a lot to do today, so if you don't mind, I'm going to go on. Now, this brings up the question of the interpretation of the whole story, okay? And I suggested in class last time that it's a folk tale of origins, that the Hebrew people got it, and they're defined by the Exodus, leaving Egypt. We'll see this right up through Dante. It's very powerful in Dante's mind. And it represents, for a Christian thinker in the Middle Ages, it's the ultimate symbol of the escape of the human spirit from the bondage of sin. Is prefigured, your individual salvation is prefigured by the release of the Hebrews from Exodus. This fits that pattern I called typology, where people read these old stories in as prefigurements of later events. Right? In this case, a political event is thought very powerfully to symbolize your personal salvation. But Andrew Lloyd Webber, and I brought this thing for 4 days, so I'm going to show a little bit of it. In the movie or the play or the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, it really runs a different interpretation of this. The story of Joseph for him is really a typical what's called a Bildungsroman, a story of the young sensitive artist who his brothers gang up on him because he's sort of the dreamer, right? The poet, the guy who doesn't play football, he makes good, right? Which is the theme of a Bildungsroman. Have any of you ever read James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man? Yeah, that's a Bildungsroman, the young James Joyce living there in Dublin, Ireland, in the cold and the damp. But by God, he's going to be the greatest writer of the 20th century and eventually write Ulysses, right? So the story of his life, the portrait of the artist, is this Bildungsroman. And I want you to hear that a bit. There's also a huge thing about the promised land that Weber puts in there, which I don't think is necessarily running through the Joseph story as I read it. And I'm going to play this just to liven up the class a little bit. But because I saw this in Chicago, like 30 years after it came out on Broadway. I mean, I'm always late to things. And I thought it was really good. And I'm just sort of curious what you think of it. There are just some really cool parts in it. But I'm not sure whether the video captures the magic. So I'm not going to give a whole class. We're not going to look at the whole thing. But I just thought I'd show you a bit. I really think you should rent it because it's kind of fun to watch. And as opposed to Andrew Lloyd Webber's later stuff, which some of it escapes me, to put it mildly. I like this because all the songs, each song is a different kind of song. Like the Pharaoh sings an Elvis Presley type rock song, and the Joseph Brothers do country western, and there's this kind of French fan dance later on. All right, so let's just, I got to figure out how to get to the, hang on. Is it coming on? You may just be listening to this. Thank you. the dream theme. It's Donny Osmond. I'll try and fix that. I can't believe this thing doesn't work. This is bothers me. The reason I bring in the boombox is I came down and tested the CDs, and they got the thing, the volume on the CD player turned down so low in the computer, I can't use it. But I did not think to do this. Now am I going to get this thing back? Right now I'm not even getting the computer. So anyway, on we go. You get the point? It's his interpretation. It's fun, and if I get it again, I'll show it to you. So we hit, that's where we were, and that's where we're going to wind up. Well, this will speed things up. Anything else in this Genesis story I want you to notice? On page 60, just to repeat what I said, the story seems to be about sending a son somewhere. And Joseph keeps sending the brothers back because he wants them to send Benjamin down, and they're afraid he'd die there. Okay. Then there's the trick where Joseph puts the silver goblet in the bag of his youngest brother, Benjamin. They accuse him of theft. All right. Why Joseph has to play this trick on everybody is, seems to have more to do with the story than any meaning. People just like stories about tricksters. It's interesting on page 62 when Joseph says, you went and stole this silver cup, you 11 file brothers. Are you dumb? Don't you know that I can divine? This is like the fourth line in the first paragraph. You see that? The paragraph that starts, and Judah with his brothers came into Joseph's house, for he was still there, and they threw themselves before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What is this deed you have done? Did you not know that a man like me could surely divine?" So he not only reads dreams, right? He can find lost or stolen objects. So he's got all these powers. In fact, he's a sort of center of magic. And the story, you can see this as a story about the contest of magic. Who's got the more powerful god behind him? Joseph, read dreams, find lost objects, or Pharaoh, whose mighty magicians, you know, certainly do a lousy job with the plague later. We don't see. So Moses, you know, beats him there, but Moses has the more powerful magic in the plague. But even here, the magicians and the diviners working for Pharaoh can't figure out really as simple a dream as seven fat cows and seven lean cows, which means what? Yeah, Joseph says it means you're going to have 7 years of prosperity than 7 years of famine. That part, you know, maybe that's not totally obvious, but it's reasonably obvious. I mean, if you're in the dream business, you would think that that would be a normal interpretation. My favorite part, though, the top of page 58, just to flip back, Joseph does have one little thing I don't think I would have thought of. And that is in the third line, he says, the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh two times. This means that the thing has been fixed by God and God is hastening to do it. So one dream's not enough. You got to have it twice for it to actually be true. It's like a threshold thing in case you're doing dreams. Okay? So it's the repeated dream that seems to matter. The recognition happens on page 63. And I'm going to use that term. We're going to use it a lot this semester. In terms of a story structure, there are very few ways to talk about plot, but one of the key terms is recognition, where suddenly you realize who you're talking to. In this case, Joseph's brothers realize that this agent of the Pharaoh is, in fact, the brother they sold into slavery, right? What reconciles Joseph is what goes on page 62, just before that, which is that one of the brothers named Judah is so upset by the request, or the way Joseph's concentrating on Benjamin, who's their father's favorite, that he offers himself to Joseph. Judah offers himself to Joseph in place of Benjamin. Right? That is a kind of sacrificial pattern. To get a typological term, does it remind you of anything? Okay. Well, this is Jesus sacrificing himself for mankind. It's the ransom theory of the crucifixion. And there are many theories, but that's one of the big ones, right? That's what was going on. That there was a debt to be paid, and somebody had to step up, right? And so that's enough. So we see that the whole Christian sacrifice theme right here in the story. And it's made to be a very powerful moment. This is what is good, okay? And a story that really separates good from bad. It doesn't mean that you can't have favorites. That's what's so striking in this. Because even as the brothers leave, at the bottom of page 63, you'll notice that Joseph gives Benjamin more silver than the other brothers get. So the whole theme of the Old Testament seems to be, you know, some people are just favored and some aren't. But that's the way God works. He's more interested in sacrifice than in eliminating the problem of favoritism. I don't know quite what to do with that myself, except maybe it means, you know, life is unfair. We all get dealt bad cards. And if you think you're going to, you know, that the way to get out of your problems is to whine about them, this is suggesting that you can do it all day, but it's not going to help. Right? And that's a tough lesson for most of us to learn. Right? We're all whiners at heart. And you notice on page 64 that, once Joseph reveals himself, Jacob comes down with all his sons and everybody moves to Egypt, which seems to me like an incredibly dumb idea. Right? But I think that's the point. But on the way there, in the beginning of 46, in the passage you have here, you want to open the book? And these are the things I expect you to mark, all right? Because this is what shows up in exams. I don't know how... You surely don't want to listen to me say this again. I'm not that brilliant on the tape. That's right for people who are in car accidents. Right? He goes through Beersheba. Right? So the story is saying there's a land to go back to. Right? As Jacob, whose other name is Israel, so he's got two names, comes down, he sort of leaves his mark behind, right? Well, that gets us up to Moses and the law. And this is page 64. And it's actually much more complicated in the story of the Exodus, which means the coming out of Egypt. Just before the break there, before 20, you see that the Lord said, go down and you shall come up, you and Aaron with you, and the priests and the people shall not break through to go up to the Lord. So God works through intermediaries, through a priest here. The people don't get to see him. Only Moses gets to see him. It's not a mass event. And he has to bring the word back down. And the first time he does, they're worshiping the golden idol, and he gets really angry and breaks the things apart. So let's just take a look at the Ten Commandments as they come, since they're worth looking at. They're almost symbolic. I mean, 10 is kind of a round number. What are the first four about? You should be able to mark them out. Okay. Page 65. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slaves. You shall have no other gods beside me. That's number one. Right? Number two, you shall make no carved likeness and no image of what is in the heavens or above. This is a really interesting one. We won't get into it, but it's essentially saying, you don't know anything about me. You don't know what it's like if you die. The whole thing's a mystery. You will never know. But most people don't pay any attention to that. And they go ahead and, oh yeah, a guy's got this big beard, and he's got the throne, and he's got this, and that, and all this stuff will happen. You have to skip down to the last line for the third one. You shall not take the name of the Lord in vain. And the top of the next page for number four, the Lord will not acquit whoever takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath to hallow it. So, this don't seem to be very helpful on such issues as balancing work and career and women's sports and whatever. Okay, the first four commandments all have to do with God. Then the next six, we get slightly practical. Whoops, I got it misnumbered. Oh, no. The sixth one begins about six lines down. Honor your father and your mother. Put a big star there. Okay. And then you shall not murder, two lines later. Oh, I kind of like that one. I mean, we all buy into that. But everybody debates it, don't they? It's like, okay, when you're a soldier, you get to shoot people, but it's not murder. The murder is a loaded translation here, because in the King James Version, what does it say? This is our translation lesson for the day. Thou shalt not kill. Robert Alter puts murder, and it's to get around that little problem that when you're, when you enlist, you get to shoot down anybody they tell you to. Okay. One of our problems, or drop bombs on them. So no murdering. You shall not commit adultery. Now, why do you think that showed up in there? right away. I mean, this is like number three of things that might actually, you know, worry you or me. Is it because, I mean, do you think people were committing adultery back then? And the answer is, I guess they were. That's why they have this law, all right? Because there's no sense mentioning it if nobody's doing it, right? And somebody's saying, you know, I don't see any problem here. You know, and like desperate housewives, right? Hey, I'm bored. So he's saying, here's the law. You shall not steal is number eight. You shall not bear false witness is number nine. And do not cover your fellow man's wife or his ox or his donkey. That's number 10. Don't covet. Okay? All right, so that's all you get out of this. But it's pretty pretty interesting. I don't know about from a literary standpoint. Now, this book of Job. Okay. What does Job do? The book of Job starts with the really weirdly, really strange. Because there's this little conversation going on between God and, who are they, what are they calling him in this translation? Yahweh and the accuser. Yahweh and the accuser, or God and Satan will work. Just realize that these are, all of the stuff's an interpretation, it's just a name. But the devil and God. And is there anything strange? And then what's going to happen is the accuser, the devil, or Satan is going to, like, kill all of Job's children, take away all of his fabulous wealth, ruin his health, blister his skin, you know, just completely destroy him till he's just a little bundle of protoplasm sitting in a pile of ashes, reduced to absolutely nothing. And why does this happen? And the answer in this story is, well, you can think theologically. You can see how, you know, beyond our ability to think of what's the origin of evil in the universe, that would be a philosophical issue, wouldn't it? But for us, who don't think that, so we like it in the terms of a story. Okay, we'll just admit that's probably not going to be solved. In this story, the cause is God and Satan have a bet. A what? You mean Job is suffering, all his children die? How many are there? Yeah, seven sons, three daughters, 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels. Looks a little symbolic there, but all dead because God and Satan have a bet, and God and Satan says, I bet I can make Job curse you. And God says, all right, go ahead, try. Real nice. Okay? But that's kind of this sort of humor or story side of the Old Testament. You have to realize it's kind of, there's a certain silliness to it. Well, anyway, all this stuff happens, and the movement of the book of Job is three friends of Job come by and tell him all the things that he's done wrong and all the reasons why he should curse God. And they come three times each. So you get nine long speeches, all right? And you've got excerpts of them here. And the amazing thing is, Job never curses God. That's what he does. He actually does something. He thinks, he deliberates, he says, I can either curse God or not, but and then he takes the decision in his own hand, and this is what I call a moral action. In this case, it's sort of a refusal to do something, but still an action. Later times, consider him an epic hero, because he's doing, you know, on the earth he's doing something. We're going to look at what people do in later stuff. Oedipus will do certain things, and Achilles does certain things. Well, here's Job, definitely does something. And it's almost like, with a sort of good humor, good Jewish humor here, the reason he doesn't curse God is he gets so angry at these friends who are annoying him, telling him, you know, Job, it was really all your fault. You know, you're kind of a bad guy. Like, none of us really, we sort of pretended to like you, but we don't really like you. You're sort of like mean right? You know, and you can sit over there, but not at our table. Okay. And he's going, oh, my God. You know, you're almost thinking, he's like, he's just so angry at his friends that God is not his problem, so he doesn't worry about him. But he keeps asking for an answer, and it finally comes, and this is the... page 86. So this is the one you want to know. You want to get to this. You want to know this is here for my class anyway. You don't have to know everything. But the voice of God comes down and starts to explain why he did what he did. Yahweh answered Job from the storm. Okay. And basically he says to him, who dares speak darkly words with no sense? Who the heck are you even to begin to ask me anything? I get it. You know? You don't know anything. You don't know what the whales are. You don't know what the gates of hell are. You don't know why there's lightning. You don't know anything. And that's the answer. Okay? And Job says, yeah, okay. And then God says, that's good. You're a good guy. And hey, or have some seven daughters, have seven more sons, seven daughters, have 7,000 more sheep. And he sort of makes it all better. Okay? Strange story. Okay? But clearly, I'll let you think about it. The next thing we have on here is the Psalms. What do we know about the Psalms? What? Yeah, allegedly written by King David. But again, King David's kind of a folk figure in a lot of them. There's two parts, you know, there's the young David who slew Goliath, the little kid sitting with a harp and picked up a sling and killed this guy. And then there's the later David who's the king. Those stories are sort of unconnected, but there's this later king of Israel who builds the temple and really establishes the presence in Jerusalem. Well, he was assigned these psalms. These are psalms of, these are songs of praise of God. And there's no rational way, really, to describe them. Right? Go out and read C.S. Lewis on the Psalms. Very good on the particular power of these things. They are probably meant, to a large extent, for when you've got, when everything's going wrong, you just, this is all you got. And that's sometimes enough. They're consolations for troubles to a large extent, put in the terms of praising God, which and Lewis is really nice. Why, if we have so many troubles, we would be thanking God? And that's the big paradox that you really can't explain, but that seems to be the way it works. If you've never run into these things before, the most famous one is probably Psalm 23, all right? And I was going to play it, but I'm running out of time. I keep bringing that boombox. I have this. I'll try and get it up online so you can download it for your iPod. I have Laurence Olivier reading passages of the Bible, and they're quite histrionic and, not like me. I mean, he's a great actor. Do you want to hear it or not? No? All right. He's actually really good on Job. He's actually the best on this thing called the Song of Deborah's Campaign, where she puts this nail into Sisera's head. She's one of the judges of Israel. And then she drove the nail in, pow, three times, and he fell down. He fell down dead! You know? Right? Maybe I should skip this. What do we got? With any luck, I'll make this work. Psalm 23. Okay. They put some hokey music in there first. So. Thank you.
I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Okay. What needs to be said here is this theme I've been establishing of symbolic language. To say the Lord is my shepherd is a metaphor, isn't it? That makes the speaker a sheep. Okay? And it compares God. He is like a shepherd. He's not really a shepherd because we're not really sheep. You see the metaphor? And then it's extended, and it's really quite brilliantly. It's almost like a little allegory, which is an extended metaphor. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. And you say to yourself, now what the heck does that mean? Is that good or bad? Lying down in green pastures. I mean, I don't want to lie down. I want to watch TV. And you just kind of have to assume it's good, right? So it doesn't really mean you have to lie down, huh? But it means he's doing something good for you, okay? So what would be good about, you know, in other words, you're in a, I guess it's the grass, isn't that it? The green part. So you're there where there's lots of grass. And it doesn't mean, he didn't say he gives me lots to eat, right? Because that's really not his function, right? But the experience of a sheep lying down in a green pasture is similar to whatever value you get from, or comfort you get out of God. It's like, okay, it's the spiritual food, you could say. Which is a huge metaphor, runs right through the Bible. Right? He leadeth me beside the still waters. What in a human condition is comparable to a sheep next to still waters? Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it just seems good. Right? And you want to kind of remember this experience because you're going to get a tiny little fragment of the Koran which comes to you very indirectly too and almost impossible to understand. But when you listen to the tape I've got, there's a guy saying, well, if, you know, he sends the angel down. Well, we don't know what it means, but, you know, angels are good. So something good is happening, even if you're not sure what it is. Well, here I could probably play with this, being an English professor. Still waters are better than muddy waters. Right? Sheep, you don't want your sheep, you don't want to be drinking the sheep to drink out of muddy waters, dirty, polluted waters that are still, I guess. Maybe that's it. Muddy waters is traditionally, there's an Aesop's proverb about, which is actually was used in the Renaissance. So it's like the first thing you got in first grade. I have the school book. I'll show it to you sometime. And the little children come in. I think they started school at 7, which I guess we do now, too. And they say, here's Aesop's fable about the I don't know if it was two animals. I think, okay, let's say it was a sheep was downstream and the wolf was upstream. And the sheep is eating, and the wolf upstream starts kicking the water around. So it's all muddy. So by the time it gets to the sheep, it's filthy, and it can't drink it. And the sheep says to him, why are you doing that? And the sheep says, because I can. And then you got to have the moral. So what's the moral of the story? Okay. Excuse me? That's for sure. Okay. But in this case, what they said is a variant of that. When somebody is more powerful than you, they will make trouble for you just to show you who's more powerful. Beware the powerful man. Right? They do stuff to you just to show who's boss. Right? That's a pretty heavy message for a seven-year-old first day of school. But, you know, maybe there was something to it. Anyway, this metaphor continues. The pasture, the waters. He restoreth my soul seems to come outside of the metaphor, doesn't it, of the sheep. But then we get right back into it with these paths of righteousness. And so the paths are sort of you don't really need the word paths. You can just say he teaches me righteousness. But, you know, this notion of the sheep wandering down a little road is interesting. And then the valley of the shadow of death. Again, the valley is the metaphor. But the meaning is clearly something like fear of death or something. You aren't really in a valley, okay? But you're certainly troubled, right? And then the guy, the shepherd, wards off evil with his rod and his staff, which I guess he uses to beat away the wolves, right? And then he anoints his head with oil and everything else. All right. So these are really interesting. And I won't go through them all, but page 95. In Psalm 137, a big psalm theme comes up, and in line 5, that's Jerusalem. A lot of these are praises of Jerusalem. And I want you to know that first footnote, because I keep talking about it, right? Jerusalem was captured and sacked by the Babylonians in 586 BC, and this was the Babylonian captivity, okay, during which time the Hebrew text started to be written down. The last piece that you have here is the Song of Songs, which is a very odd thing in the Bible because it's so erotic, and because half of it's in the voice of a woman, and because she's black. So nobody knows, you know, that's just the way it comes to us, right? And people read this, interpret it. It's a wild love story. And again, I think it... bears meditating on. Everybody thought it must be symbolic, so there's all kinds of symbolism attached to it. I think if I let you flip back to page 38. If you go back to page 38, you should notice, it's not that hard. In the second paragraph, you get at least three possible interpretations. I'll start about four lines down that paragraph that starts. Okay. But the incorporation of this poem in sacred scripture, you see that? Raises the possibility of further meanings. Although what these might be is open to question. This seems to me right. Are you with me on page 38? You're not fine? You got your books not lined up this way? Okay. This challenging and beautiful text has had a long history of divergent interpretations. A medieval Jewish commentator described it as locks to which the key has been lost. Is it an allegory? And if so, is it religious or is it historical? If the former, does the allegory concern the love between God and his chosen people? Okay, so that's it. The man is God, the woman is the Jewish race. Sure doesn't look like that to me, but a lot of people thought that. Okay. That's an interpretation. Christians later understood the poem to describe the love between Christ and his church, which is considered a marriage. Nuns wear a wedding ring. Okay? And it's based on this. Or between God and Christ and the individual soul. So the man is either the soul or the woman is the soul, right? You know. Anyway, those are possible interpretations. It starts in the woman's voice on page 96, and in the middle of page 97, it turns into the man's voice. So you don't want to get confused. The Bible is heterogeneous, different parts. It's not, it changes line by line. It's a conglomeration of stuff, of different forms, of bits. It does not, even though it's numbered in your home Bible, consecutively, that's not the way it actually works. Let me just see what else I have here. Let's just take a quick look. So we did, the Bible is, I think, 27 books, right? The first five are considered particularly important in the Jewish religion. They're called the Torah. And you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Essentially, it's Moses settling and getting to the Promised Land, although Moses never himself is allowed in. We've seen Genesis, the Book of Origins, Exodus, the flight from Egypt, and these are essentially the million laws that Moses came up with, including a lot of, and Numbers is really a lot of numbers. But there's other stuff in there, but that's, that, I think you should just have some overview if we're doing this. Right? And I'm going to just, then what's the rest of it? So this is the books of Moses. They're considered, if I have a slide. But in fact, it's probably written by multiple authors. In every time, all your teachers tell you never use Cliff Notes. Does anybody bother to tell you that in this computer age? All right, forget it. You can always use Cliff Notes. If you got time to read them, good. All right, particularly on the Old Testament, excellent book, excellent single one-volume book on the Old Testament if you've ever got into a Bible as literature course. And it is particularly good on the different authors that they can identify who contributed to the biblical books. There's a priestly author because he sort of gives special attention to the priest. There's the guy they call the Eloist because he uses the word Elohim for God. There's the combined authors, and J and P and E and D, that the scholars have given these codes to. And I just think you should really be aware of that, right? I mean, it's just almost frightening how little a lot of people know. It's just like there's four Gospels in the New Testament, and the thing you'll get out of this class is they're all different. They're all different. They have some similarities, but there are a lot of differences, too. And we'd just like you to be aware of that because that's important. So here we go. The Torah, the first five books. The books of Judges, that's where you get Samson and Delilah, stories like that, Joshua. First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings. This is essentially the historical books, the life of David, Solomon, everything that's sort of happening around 1200, and we're not doing it all in this class. And then you get this set of books called Chronicles, which are like a really badly written version of Samuel and David. This is the overview here. In other words, it repeats the material. So no one ever studies Chronicles, right? But it's pretty interesting stuff to look at. And it's in, you know, when they say, I believe in the Bible. I don't think a lot of people are going to Chronicles, but they might. So that's that. And, oh God, I'm going to do this. Then you get the prophets. So let's just take a quick look at the prophets since we're not mentioning them at all. Generally, the prophets are lamenting either the captivity in Babylon or the release, or talking about the release and then being disgusted with the behavior of the people who should behave better after having been captive, right? The first one named Ezra, okay, lived during the time of Cyrus of Persia. Same guy I was talking about back on page 2 of your book, okay, who was a Persian who in this year, 539, returned the Jews to Babylon from Palestine. These are the same Persians who will be invading the Greek Peloponnese and producing, after which Greek tragedy is produced, which we're going to do in about 2 weeks. Right? So these are the dates you want to know. Was it 586 or 589 on that footnote that I was just looking at? And so that's roughly 50 years. Although they always talk of it in terms of 70 years for some reason. Anyway, the whole area is in conflict, you know, after the fall of the Assyrian Empire, back then when Gilgamesh was written down, not when it was composed, but when it was written down, right? Another prophet, Nehemiah, laments the Jews left behind in Babylon. Another book, it comes among the prophetic books, but really isn't prophetic, is the book of Esther. And I just want to mention this one, because it's in the Jewish Bible, but that's not. Everybody recognizes that this is not a Jewish name; it's a Persian name. Okay, it's a wild story about the killing, the defeat of the tyrant king Ahasuerus. All right, which unfortunately we can't get into, but this is a form of Ishtar, which you can go back to your page 21 of your book. In the Gilgamesh, and you'll see that she's a goddess of love. So this Persian goddess of love shows up as a female heroine in the Bible. In one of the Otter books, okay, which is really unrelated in tone and sensibility to almost everything else in the Old Testament, but nonetheless it's there. Okay, I would assume any decent women's studies class pays a lot of attention to it. It's a fun book. Sorry, it's not in the anthology. So you know about Esther, you know about Ishtar. I'm running out of time. You okay? You'll pick this up later. And then there's Job. We just looked at Psalms. Proverbs is a whole book. There's a book of Proverbs. There's this book called Ecclesiastes, which is a very weird book. And the Song of Solomon, which is the same thing as the Song of Songs that we just looked at. Okay, some people say Solomon sang it because he had a reputation as a great lover. Right? So you know that there's this, you should look through this. There's a list of all the prophets. Isaiah, long, complicated, but in the middle of it, he predicts the birth of a son who's going to save everybody. And this is the key text for the New Testament. And he has a song of the suffering servant, the guy who does everything for you. Nobody appreciates, they torture him. Right? All found in Isaiah, and it's a type of what happens later. Jeremiah, there's actually two authors, and so the first 40 chapters are different from the other ones. Daniel, who was in the lion's den, that's enough of that. Okay, so with all that, we closed the Bible, and with 15 minutes ago, we turned to Homer. Okay, the single greatest poem ever written, right? And we're going to do the 15-minute Iliad now. Yeah, you'll get this. All right. I hope it'll be fairly incomprehensible if you weren't here in class, but if you were here, it'll be a good memory guide. But it won't go up till a week or two before the exam. It won't go up right away. I want you reading the book, not my notes, right? But it'll be there when you need it. Okay. So let's think about the Iliad. Just really quickly, this is the Trojan War. The story of a bunch of people from the Greek Peloponnesus, who are called Achaeans, not Greeks. And they go to Troy. And the cause of the war was Helen of Troy, who was the wife of King Menelaus of Sparta. But somehow this guy named Paris came over from Troy and didn't know about that thou shalt not commit adultery thing, and had an affair with her, and took her away back to Troy, infuriating Menelaus, whose brother happened to be very powerful, Agamemnon, who was capable of leading armies. And they put together a huge armada and sailed over to Troy, and the war traditionally took 10 years. Now, in the 19th century, they kind of proved it really happened, but we're not get into that. There was clearly plenty of time for wars to happen at this time, and the broad outlines in general are kind of historical, but as we get it, we'll just treat it as a story. Even the ancient Greek historians thought about the origins of the Trojan War, and they realized, it can't be that simple that Paris just came over and stole Helen. I think those Greeks are doing something bad to the Trojans first, and this was just payback. Take the guy's wife. And they trace it all the way back to Jove coming down and assuming the shape of a cow and taking a woman named Europa out of Asia and sailing with her over to Greece. You see, that was the original kidnapping of an Asian woman, and so Paris was just sort of payback, right? But there were many, many, many steps. We don't need to worry about those. Okay. The main story here is the genius of Homer, as Aristotle said, was not to tell the story of the 10 years of the Trojan War and to go back 1,000 years to give you all the history, because we'd be bored out of our skulls. What he did was he picked a particular incident surrounding the wrath of Achilles, which takes place in 3 weeks, and focused his story on that. And that ability to take the formless matter of history and find one particular story that says it all is the genius of the literary artist. And Homer's the first one. And Aristotle was the guy that said, look at what he's doing. He's getting it right. Okay? When you go to tell your story of your life, you don't just start the day you were born and in the day you died. Find some shape to it. So the shape centers around the wrath of Achilles. So I'm on page 107 here. And let me pause to get this straight. I want you to look at, if you haven't looked at the Hebrew first lines on the website, do so this weekend. And what I want you to tell me, I've got one person email me. Where's Laura? Are you here? Lara? Is that you? Okay, thank you. I'm sure the other emails are lost, but I know they'll be coming in. Let me know what you think of it. What I'd really like to know is what you learned from these texts. What the dean wants to know is, what he said to me when he saw these, he said, I think these are too complicated for your students. So just tell me that. If these things are too confusing for you to understand, then let me know. If you think you've picked up something, just tell me the most interesting thing that you think you learned, all right? Okay, they're all online. Like, you all have access to high-speed computers, right? Somewhere on this campus. What? Yeah, just you can send it as an email. It's short, all right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I just treat one each individually. What did you think of the Hebrew one? What do you think of the Greek one? Did you think it helped? You know, I just really kind of personal reaction. That's for the dean. He just thinks it's over the average person's head. I don't think so. I don't know. I think you guys are smart. But I'd like to know what you liked, and that's just personal. Anyway, let's go back to the first word of the Iliad. So that tape really works over the first 7 lines of the Iliad. And when you get done, not only will you know how to say, you know, Bereshit bara Adonai, Bereshit bara Adonai, yet Hashemayim v'yet haharetz, you will come in here at some point and say, Menin aida thea te elia du Achilleas. I sing the wrath of Achilles, the son of Peleus. Right? You go, whoa. Right? So you'll know some Hebrew, you'll know some Greek. And I actually have another slideshow. Where is it? All right, so this is what I'm trying to cram in right now. Okay. If you've ever seen a movie version of Homer, didn't Brad Pitt do the Iliad? Wasn't he Achilles? Was it Brad Pitt? It was called Troy? I mean, those movies are always really awful. Okay, really awful. They just don't even bother to read it. But you know, they're doing something else. They've got other things to do. There was one that was of the Odyssey, which is you're doing for next Tuesday already. And it started with literally 35 minutes of Odysseus' wife giving birth to his son. I mean, all the, you know, the screams and the knotted sheets and all that stuff and the basins of water. You know, so. But that's what people were interested in 10 years ago. It's not really Homer. Okay. This starts with a plague. Apollo is raining down punishment on the Greek camp. Okay? And nobody knows why. Apollo is the son of Zeus. And just quickly, as you keep tracking him, he's a really interesting god because he's a complete screw-up. all the time. That's the key to Apollo. He is really the spoiled son of the king. You want to watch those guys. They're just sons of powerful men. They don't, you know, this is Apollo. He is a kind of cold-blooded, unfeeling guy. Line 16. Chrysis had come to the Greek beachhead hauling a fortune for his daughter's ransom. The Greeks had sent out some kind of raiding party. They had captured this guy's daughter. He wants her back. Right? And he'd not, and they don't give him to her. And they don't give her to him. But he's not nobody. He's Apollo's priest. And he gets Apollo in on the act. And Apollo loves nothing more than like raining down hell and destruction on people. So he does. Okay? And at line 61, we learn for 9 days the gods' arrows rained on the camp. And then finally, at line 66, up stood the great runner Achilles and said, "Well, Agamemnon, I think we better get out of here because it's like everybody's dying of the plague on this beach next to these ships. You know, they're about 2 miles from this walled city of Troy. Let's get the heck out of here." Okay? Because we don't know what's going on. Top of the page, one on. Who could tell us why Apollo is so angry? And he sits down. Now this is the guy. You've got to picture yourself as Agamemnon. He don't really know what's wrong. I mean, I kept a girl, but I do that all the time. You know? Okay. What I do has nothing to do with any plague or anything. And Achilles says, "Who can tell us why Apollo is so angry?" And then this magician gets up, and his name is Calchas, there in line 94. But he starts speaking in line 82, and he says, I'm Calchas. I can tell you what's going on, okay? Because I'm also in contact with supernatural forces, just like Chrysis has sort of got Apollo working for him. But, you know, me too. Contest of magics, okay? We're going to see who's more powerful here. Right? But what's really going on is you got Achilles sort of pushing an Agamemnon who's not giving the girl back. But it's being played out as this contest of magic. Calchas stands up in line 84 and says, "I'm going to tell everybody who's at fault." And the answer is going to be Agamemnon because he's keeping the slave girl, the daughter of Chrysis. "But I'm afraid of Agamemnon. So," he says, "I want protection in case what I say offends powerful people." Line 84. "But you have to promise me and swear you will support me and protect me in word and deed." And that's it, right? Do you think, and I guess my question is, it looks, the whole thing looks staged by Achilles, okay? So there's more going on than it really looks like in the story. This is why it's so difficult to read this on your own, just sort of straight out, because you sort of really have to sit there and think from it. It's very dramatic. It just seems almost impossibly unlikely that Calchas just out of nowhere stood up because Achilles just one day decided to ask, who can tell us, okay? And there's two ways of saying that, aren't there? There's the real question, who can tell us what's going on? Or there's like the rhetorical question, who can tell us? I know, but I gotta set it up so I can get Agamemnon really angry, okay, because I really can't stand that guy. And I know he's a fathead and he won't give the daughter back, right? I gotta really provoke him. So it's a setup, and it sure gets Agamemnon angry when he finds out, right? And that's at line 107, when this Calchas finishes speaking and saying that the whole problem is Apollo is angry because Agamemnon won't give back this girl. He finished speaking at line 106 or so, 107, and sat down. Then up rose Atreus' son, the warlord Agamemnon, furious, anger like twin black thunderheads. And he's a jerk. Because the first thing he does is he blames Calchas for the trouble. He blames the messenger. He doesn't stand up and say, "Well, maybe there is some problem with me keeping that girl." Instead, he blames the bearer of bad news. It's those damn Democrats. That's why. Okay. This is most famously, Cleopatra is famous for beating the messenger who told her that Antony had gotten married in Rome. You know, lift that guy. No, he's just doing his job. So this is beating the messenger. All right. Well, Achilles, I mean, Agamemnon is a bad, kind of bad guy. And he says here, line 121, I'm keeping this girl. And he has to, because he has to save face, because he's a king. Right? And we can look at, I just don't have time to do this whole story justice, but there's a whole notion of role-playing and everything here. And he lets out this line at 121, which is unbelievable. I like her better, I like this girl, this slave girl, I like her better than Clytemnestra, my wife. Right? Well, you got to think a lot of yourself to talk like that. And in fact, after they conquer Troy and Agamemnon comes home, his wife is sitting there waiting for him with a hot bath and a knife, and she slits his throat in it, and she's really ticked. Okay. So Mr. Fathead here, who thinks he's so all-important, really gets his. I mean, Clytemnestra's got the boyfriend, Aegisthus, and, you know, and we're going to see that when we read the Agamemnon. That's a Greek tragedy, right? The whole dust settles. Jump to line 194. Finally, Agamemnon has to agree. The pressure's too much. But he's really burned up at Achilles for setting him up like that. Okay? And everything's a setup. And everything's related. I mean, the whole notion that Chryses comes to get his daughter back replays the Greeks going to Troy to get Helen back. Okay? This retrieval of the woman. Okay? Here we get a replay. Agamemnon says to Achilles, well, if they're taking my girl, I'm coming to take yours. I want this one named Briseis, your slave girl. And since I'm king, I can't be left without, so I have to take yours. And Achilles goes bananas and starts to weep in line 198. And he thinks, should I kill Agamemnon right now? Because Achilles is the most powerful warrior, Brad Pitt, right? But, okay, so he gets, And he's thinking, should I kill this guy? And at the top of 112, the whole poem changes for us. This separates Homer from everything. Athena comes down and tells him to calm down and wait, that everything will work out the way he wants. What does it mean for Athena to come down? She's the goddess of wisdom. So this is almost an allegorical fantasy way of saying Achilles started to think hard. But of course it's not that. It's the story of a goddess coming down. But it works both ways. All right? Well, I guess we're out of time for today. And have a good read. We're going to do the Iliad, the Odyssey on Tuesday. So hang on to your hat. The next thing, I can only make three big points. I might as well do them now. In book six, you see Helen saying, oh, God, this war's over me. Aren't I a bitch? And I say, is that the first time that this is the latest feminist criticism? Is she playing the role of a woman? I don't think she really means it. I think she's role-playing what the men want. And then look at the shield of Achilles in book 18. So those are the three big things. I'll get to this anyway.